and then staring fixedly at his brother, who waited patiently at the foot of the stairs. A faint smile crossed his lips as he paused confusedly.
"What do you think, brother? Am I really mad? If not me, then why, it must be everyone else, and I alone am sane. Say something, Balinor. We should have that talk now, before. I did want to say something."
But the sentence was left unfinished as he straightened his tall frame and looked back once again at Stenman, who had taken on the appearance of a dangerously cornered animal, crouched and waiting to attack.
"You are pathetic, Stenman. Stand up!"
The sharp command cut through the stillness, and the bent figure of the mystic snapped upright.
"Advise me what I should do," Palance ordered sharply. "Do I have everyone killed? Will that protect me?"
In an instant, Stenman was back at his side, the sharp eyes cold with fury.
"Call your guard, my lord. Dispose of these assassins now."
Suddenly, Palance seemed to waver, his tall frame drooping, his eyes glancing at the walls of the cellar in studied concentration of the stonework. Minion sensed that the Prince of Calahorn was again losing his grip on reality and falling back into the clouded world of madness that had impaired his once sound reason. Stenman recognized it as well, a grim smile creeping over his dark face, his hand coming up to stroke the small, pointed beard. Then abruptly, Palance spoke once more.
"No. There will be no soldiers. No killing. A king must be a man of judgment. Balinor is my brother, though he wishes to be king in my place. He and I must talk now. He is not to be harmed. Not harmed."
His voice trailed off, and he smiled unexpectedly at Minion.
"You brought Sherl back to me. I thought I had lost her, you know. Why would you do that if you were an enemy?"
Stenman screamed in fury, grasping furiously at the other's tunic, but the prince did not seem to realize he was even there.
"It is difficult for me to think clearly, Balinor,"
Palance continued in a low whisper, shaking his head slowly.
"Nothing is clear anymore. I don't even feel angry toward you for wanting to be king. I have always wanted to be king. I have, you know. But I have to have friends. Someone to talk to."
He turned dispassionately toward Stenman, his eyes blank and expressionless. Something his advisor saw there caused the mystic to release his grip on the other's arm and shrink limply back against the stone wall, his jaw sagging in fear. Only Menion was close enough to realize what had happened. Whatever hold the evil mystic had managed to secure over Palance Buckhanna was gone. The man's already muddled thought processes had been pushed beyond the brink of even basic comprehension of identities, and Stenman was now no more than another face in a sea of indistinguishable beings that haunted the nightmare world of the maddened Prince of Calahorn.
"Palance, listen to me,"
Menion called softly to him, reaching through the web of darkness to the man beneath for just an instant. The broad figure turned slightly.
"Call Sherl down from her room. Call Sherl, and she will help you."
The prince hesitated for a moment as if trying to remember. Then a small smile crossed his haggard face, and a deep calm seemed to settle through his whole body. He remembered her soft voice, her gentle manner, her fragile beauty. memories that recalled peace and serenity, moments of deep affection that he had never found with any other human being. If he could just be with her for a while. "Sherl," he spoke her name softly and turned back to the closed cellar door, one hand outstretched. As he brushed past Stenman, the crouched mystic seemed suddenly to go berserk. Shrieking with rage and frustration, he threw himself at the other man, grappling wildly at his tunic front. Responding instantly, Menyanli bounded quickly toward the high landing to part the struggling men. But he was still several steps away when Stenman's lean hand drew back momentarily, holding high a long dagger seized from beneath his robes. The weapon raised and for one terrible second hung poised above the men as Balinor cried out in helpless shock. Then it fell. Palance Buckhanna rose sharply to his full height, the dagger buried to the hilt in his broad chest, a terrible whiteness flooding his young face. "I give you back your brother, fool," shrieked the maddened Stenman, shoving the rigid form down the stone stairway. The stricken prince fell heavily into Menyan's outstretched arms, knocking him back roughly against the wall, causing him momentarily to lose his balance and the opportunity to reach the hated enemy. Stenman had already turned to flee, pulling frantically on the massive cellar door. Balinor bounded up the stairway, desperately trying to stop the mystic's escape, the elven brothers immediately behind him, yelling for the guards. The scarlet figure had pulled the door partially open and was just slipping to freedom when Hendel, still standing at the foot of the stairs, seized a discarded mace and hurled it wildly at the fleeing man. It struck the mystic's exposed shoulder with bone-crunching force, and a scream of pain echoed off the dank walls. Yet it wasn't enough to stop him completely, and a moment later he had disappeared through the doorway. From the hallway beyond, they could hear his shrill cry that the prisoners had assassinated the king. Balinor paused only an instant in his pursuit to glance down on the still form resting quietly in the strong arms of Menyanli, then raced for the open cellar door. Two black-clad palace guards appeared suddenly from the hallway beyond, swords drawn, to confront the unarmed bordermen. They could have been statues for all the difference their unexpected appearance made to Balinor, who bowled them over with a lightning assault, seizing a fallen sword as he disappeared from view. Durin and Dale were only steps behind. Menyan knelt alone on the stairway, gazing after them and holding the stricken palance, cradling gently the body of the self-proclaimed King of Calahorn. Silently, Hendel climbed the stone steps to stand beside him, shaking his grizzled head sadly. The prince was still alive, the shallow breathing harsh and the eyelids twitching sporadically. Grimly, the dwarf reached down as Menyan held the limp form and slowly withdrew the deadly blade, casting the weapon away with disgust. The dwarf bent to help the Highlander raise the wounded man, and abruptly the eyes opened for an instant. Palance spoke softly, a barely perceptible murmur, and then drifted into unconsciousness once more. "He's calling for Shurl," Menyan whispered, tears in his eyes as he glanced briefly at the other. "He still loves her. He still loves her." In the hallway beyond, Balinor and the elven brothers were struggling to catch the fleeing Stenman. Everything was in a state of utter confusion as guards, household servants, and visitors milled through the panic-stricken palace. Shouts of terror echoed off the ancient walls, decrying the death of the king and warning of assassins bent on killing everyone. The sounds of still another battle rose from the palace gates to add to the growing chaos. Balinor and his two companions fought their way through the knots of frightened people, who seemed to go into a state of complete hysteria at the sight of drawn weapons. A few scattered guards even attempted to bar their passage, but each time the giant border man merely flung the unfortunate men aside without pausing and raced in pursuit of the red-cloaked figure stumbling ahead. Stenman was still in sight when the three pursuers reached the central hallway, but he had broken through the hindering throngs and was beginning to draw away. With unbelievable fury, Balinor pushed ahead, heedlessly knocking everyone in his path aside, his face grim and terrible. Then suddenly the palace doors shuddered under the weight of dozens of battling men and burst open with a crash, directly in front of the giant border man and his elven friends. The confusion was complete as a huge knot of fighting men rushed wildly into the entryway and the halls beyond, shouting for Balinor and waving their drawn weapons with grand flourishes. For a moment the prince was uncertain who they were. Then he saw that they were wearing the leopard insignia of the Border Legion. The few palace guards who remained either fled or threw down their weapons and were seized. The Legion soldiers immediately spotted Balinor and rushed over to him, grasping him and raising him to their shoulders with cheers of victory. Durin and Dale were cut off from him, and the cheering mass of men barred their pursuit of the rapidly disappearing Stenman. Balinor shouted and struggled furiously, desperately trying to break away, but the sheer weight of numbers prevented him from resisting the tide that suddenly surged forward, carrying him back toward the cellar. The frustrated elves finally broke through the mass of bodies, racing after their quarry, who had turned down a different hallway and was momentarily lost from sight. The lean elves were very fast, however, and closed the gap between themselves and Stenman in a matter of seconds. Rounding the corner of the hallway, they caught sight of him once again, the dark face flushed with terror, the right arm hanging limp and useless. Silently, Durin cursed himself for having failed to pick up a longbow. Abruptly, the fleeing man halted and vainly tried to wrest open one of the several doors lining the left side of the passage. The latch held despite the mystic's repeated efforts to force it, and at last he turned once more and raced to open the next door down the hall. Durin and Dale were only yards away as Stenman succeeded in opening this one and disappeared inside, closing it with a resounding crash. The elves were there in seconds. Finding the door secured from within, they proceeded to force the iron latch with their swords. The clasp was sturdy, and it took them several endless minutes to break through. By the time they pried open the door and burst into the room with swords held ready, it was deserted. Minionly stood quietly at the front gates of the Buckhanna home as Balinor conversed in low tones with the commanders of the Border Legion. Shirl was next to him, one slim arm locked in his, her young face lined with worry in the noon sunlight. Minion glanced down at her momentarily and smiled reassuringly, holding her closer to him. Beyond the great outer wall of the city of Tirsus, two divisions of the reassembled Border Legion waited patiently for the command that would take them into battle against the awesome Northland army. The huge invasion force had reached the northern banks of the swollen Myrmidon River, and even now was beginning to make its crossing. If the Legion could hold the southern bank, even for a few days, it might give the elven armies a chance to mobilize and march to their aid. Time, Menyon thought bitterly. All they needed was just a little more time, and so far they hadn't gotten it. The Border Legion had been reassembled as quickly as possible once the city was secured and Balinor was reinstated as commander, but by that time the advancing Northlanders had already reached the Myrmidon and begun preparations for the crossing. Balinor was now King of Calahorn, though it was anything but a cause for celebration. His brother lay in a coma, weakened and extremely close to death. The best physicians in Tirsus had examined him with labored patience in an effort to determine the cause of his irrational behavior, and after some time had concluded that he had been given a powerful drug over a long period of time to break down his resistance and reduce him, for all practical purposes, to a mindless puppet. Finally, the dosage had been increased to the point where his mind and body had been pushed beyond the point of physical and mental endurance. In the end, his madness was real. Balinor had listened to their conclusions without comment. An hour earlier, he had found his father in a deserted room in the north tower of the Buckhanna home. The aged king had been dead for several days, and a physician's report revealed that he had been systematically poisoned. Stenman had kept everyone from that room except himself and the already unbalanced Palance, so the secret of Rule Buckhanna's death had been easily kept. Had the mystic succeeded in having Balinor killed, it would have been a simple matter to persuade Palance to open the gates to the armies of the warlock lord, and in so doing, assure the destruction of Tirsis. He had nearly succeeded once, and he might still do so. Stenman had managed to elude the elven brothers and was hidden somewhere within the city. In a very real sense, the future of the Southland rested in the hands of the Prince of Callahorn. The people of Tirsis looked to the Buckhanna family for dependable government and strong leadership. The Border Legion functioned best as a fighting unit when Balinor was in command. Now the giant borderman was the last of his family and the man to whom everyone turned for leadership, whether openly or subconsciously. If anything were to happen to him, the Legion would lose its finest commander and the heart of its fighting strength, while the city would lose the last Buckhanna. The few who fully understood the gravity of the situation realized that Tirsis must be held against the advancing Northland army, or the Southland would be lost and a wedge driven between the armies of the elves and the dwarves. Alanon had warned them that if this should happen, the warlock lord had won. Tirsis was the key to success or failure, and Balinor was the key to Tirsis. Janus Senpre had carried out his part in securing the city earlier that morning. After Menyon left him at the gates, he sought out the Legion commanders, Fandwick and Jinison. Secretly, they reassembled key members of the disbanded Legion and, striking quickly and quietly, seized the gates and the army barracks. Moving rapidly toward the palace, they gained strength almost without opposition until finally the entire city surrounding the Buckhanna family home and gardens was resecured. Waiting just outside the palace grounds for a signal from Minion, the three commanders and their followers heard the cries within of assassination. Fearing the worst, they rushed the gates, forcing their way inside just in time to prevent Balinor from catching the fleeing Stenman. There was almost no loss of life in the brief uprising, and the followers of Palance were either imprisoned or freed to rejoin their old units in the Legion. Already two of the five Legion divisions were reassembled, and the other three would be formed up and properly armed by sunset. But scouts from the city had reported to Balinor the progress of the Northlanders in reaching the Myrmidon, and concluded that he must act immediately to prevent the crossing. Hendel and the Elven brothers lounged restlessly off to the right on the steps of the palace, their faces reflecting mixed emotions. The dwarf appeared as resolute as ever, his aging countenance implacable as he glanced casually over at the Highlander and his beautiful charge. Durin seemed somehow older, his lean elven features clouded by the knowledge of what lay ahead, while Dale, though shadowed by the same uncertainty, managed a cheerful smile. Menyon shifted his gaze back to Balinor and the Legion commanders. Jinison was heavy-set with shocking red hair and powerful arms. Fandwick was aged and grizzled with a drooping white mustache and a scowl to match. Acton was a man of medium height and regular appearance, whose horsemanship was said to be matchless. Messaline was tall and broad-shouldered, almost arrogant-looking as he rocked carelessly back on his heels while Balinor spoke to them. And last came Jonas Sempre, recently promoted to full commander in recognition of his courageous stand at Kern and his vital role in the recapture of Tirsus. Menyon studied them carefully for long minutes, as if somehow his visual appraisal could ascertain their worth. Then Balinor turned and walked over to him, motioning for Hendel and the elves to join them. "I'm leaving at once for the Myrmidon," he informed them quietly when they were all together. Menyon started to speak, but Balinor quickly cut him off. "No, Menyon. I know what you are going to ask, and the answer is no. You will all remain here in the city. I would trust any one of you with my life, and since my life is of secondary importance in comparison with Tirsus, I ask you to guard the city instead. If anything should happen to me, you will know best how to continue the battle. Jonas remains with you in command of the city defenses, and I have instructed him to confer with you on all matters." "Eventine will come," Dale spoke quickly, trying hard to sound cheerful. Balinor smiled and nodded in agreement. "Alanon has never failed. He won't fail us now." "Don't expose yourself unnecessarily," Hendel warned grimly. "This city and its people depend on you. They need you alive." "Goodbye, old friend." Balinor gripped the dwarf's hand tightly. "I depend on you most of all. Your experience is twice mine, and you are twice the strategist. Take care." He turned quickly, motioning for his commanders, and entered the waiting carriage that would convey them to the city gates. Jonas Sempre waved reassuringly to Menyon as the palace coach drew away, the mounted escort falling into sharp formation to the rear, and the gallant procession galloped with a clashing of iron-shod hooves toward the Sendic Bridge. The four companions and Shurl Ravenlock watched until they were lost from sight, and the thunder of the horses had drifted into silence. Then Hendel muttered absently about checking the palace once more for some sign of the missing Stenman, and without waiting for a response, re-entered the Buckhanna home. Durin and Dale trailed after him, feeling strangely disconsolate. It was the first time they had been separated from Balinor for more than several hours since the long journey from Cullhaven had begun many weeks earlier, and it was a disquieting experience to allow him to go on alone to the Myrmidon. Minion knew exactly how they felt, his own restless nature inwardly urging him to go after the Borderman, to join him in the crucial battle against the hordes of the Warlock Lord. But he was nearly exhausted. He had not slept for almost 2 days. The strain of the battle above the island of Kern, the long flight down the Myrmidon, and the rapid series of events which had led to the freeing of Balinor and the others had sapped even his great stamina. Almost drunkenly, he steered Shurl into the gardens at the side of the palace, dropping heavily onto a wide stone bench. The girl sat quietly next to him, watching his face as he closed his eyes and forced his mind to relax. "I know what you must be thinking, Menyon." Her soft voice drifted gently through his weariness. "You want to be with him." The Highlander smiled and nodded slowly, his thoughts hazy and jumbled. "You must get some sleep, you know." Again he nodded, and suddenly he thought of Shay. Where was Shay? Where had the Veilman wandered in his futile search for the elusive sword of Shannara? Quickly he raised himself, snapping awake and turning to Shurl, almost as if he thought she might not be there. He was exhausted, but he wanted to talk. He needed to talk, because there might never be another chance. In low, somber tones, he began to speak to her, telling her about himself and Shay, unfolding in bits and pieces the friendship that had so closely bound them in the years they had known one another. He spoke of the times they had spent in the highlands of Lee, drifting gradually into the full story behind the journey to Perenor and the search for the sword. At times he rambled in vain attempts to explore in depth the rationale behind feelings they had shared and philosophies they could not. As the Highlander continued, Cheryl began to realize that it was not really Shay that Mennion was trying to describe. It was himself. Finally, she stopped him, reaching without thinking to place a slim hand over his lips. "He was the only person you ever really got to know, wasn't he?" she asked quietly. "He was like a brother, and you feel responsible for what happened to him?" Mennion shrugged disconsolately. "I couldn't have done anything but what I did. Keeping him in Lee in the first place would have only prolonged the inevitable. But knowing all that doesn't help. I still feel a sort of guilt." "If he feels as deeply for you as you do for him, then he knows in his heart the truth of what you have done. Wherever he is now," she responded quickly. "No man can fault you for the courage you have shown these past 5 days. And I love you, Mennion Lee." Mennion stared at her stupidly, the sudden declaration catching him off balance. Laughing at his confusion, the slim girl wrapped her arms around him, the reddish locks falling like a soft veil about his face as she clung to him. Mennion held her close for a moment, then gripped her shoulders gently and pushed her back to study her face and eyes. She met his gaze squarely. "I wanted to say it out loud. I wanted you to hear it, Mennion. If we are going to die..." She choked suddenly on the words and looked away, and the wondering Southlander saw tears slowly roll down her cheeks. He reached up and quickly brushed them away, smiling in the old way as he raised himself to his feet, drawing her up with him. "I came a long, long way," he murmured gently. "I could have been dead 100 times, but I survived. I've seen the evil there is in this world and in worlds that mortals only dream exist. There is nothing that can hurt us. Love supplies a kind of strength that can withstand even death. But you need a little faith. Just believe, Cheryl. Believe in us." She smiled in spite of herself. "I believe in you, Mennion Lee. Now you remember to believe in yourself." The weary Highlander smiled back at her, gripping her hands tightly. She was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, and he loved her as much as his own life. He leaned down and kissed her warmly. "It will be all right," he assured her quietly. "It will all work out." They remained a few minutes longer in the solitude of the gardens, talking quietly and absently following the little paths that wound through the warm, fragrant summer flowers. But Mennion was fighting to remain awake, and Cheryl was quick to demand that he get some sleep while he had the opportunity. Still smiling to himself, he retired to his bedchamber in the palace, where he collapsed, still fully clothed, onto one of the wide, soft beds, and immediately fell into a deep, dreamless slumber. While he slept, the hours of the afternoon drifted slowly away, the sun slipping into the western sky and finally sinking in a brilliant scarlet blaze beneath the horizon. At the coming of complete darkness, the Highlander awoke, fully rested but strangely disturbed. He hastened to find Cheryl, and together they walked the almost deserted corridors of the Buckhanna home, searching for Hendel and the Elven brothers. The long hallways echoed the low tapping of their boots as they hastened past statue-like sentries and darkened rooms, pausing only momentarily to observe the still, death-like form of Palance Buckhanna, as his physicians watched over him with expressionless faces. His condition remained unchanged, his wounded body and shattered spirit struggling to survive the crushing weight of a death that was slowly, inevitably pushing down against him. When the two silent forms moved at last from his bedside, there were tears again in Cheryl's dark eyes. Convinced that his friends had gone to the city gates to await the return of the Prince of Calahorn, Menyon saddled two horses and the couple rode toward the Tirzian Way. It was a cool, cloudless night lighted by the silver shimmer of the moon and stars, and the towers of the city stood clearly outlined against the sky. As the horses swung onto the bridge of Sendik, Menyon felt the welcome coolness of a friendly night breeze blowing in soothing waves over his flushed face. It was unusually quiet along the Tirzian Way, the streets deserted and the houses that lined the way lighted but empty of laughter and friendly conversation. An audible hush had settled over the besieged city, a grim, whispering solitude that hovered and waited for the death that came with battle. The riders rode anxiously through this eerie silence, trying to find some comfort in the beauty of the starlit sky that seemed to promise a thousand tomorrows for the races. The towering heights of the outer wall loomed blackly in the distance, and on the parapets burned hundreds of torches, lighting the way home to the soldiers of Tirsis. They had been gone a long time, Menyon thought to himself. But perhaps they had been more successful than anyone had dared to hope. Perhaps they had held the Myrmidon against the Northland hordes. Moments later, the riders were dismounting at the mammoth gates of the giant wall. The Legion barracks were alive with activity as the restless garrison worked feverishly in preparation for the battle to come. There were knots of soldiers at every turn, and it was with considerable difficulty that Menyon and Cheryl finally managed to reach the ramparts at the top of the broad walls, where they were greeted warmly by Janus Senpre. The youthful commander had maintained his vigilant lookout without rest since Balinor had departed, and the slim face was lined with weariness and anxiety. After a few moments, Durin and Hendel appeared out of the darkness to join them, followed somewhat later by a wandering Dale. The little group stood in silence and stared into the darkness that ran northward to the Myrmidon and the Border Legion. From far away they could hear the muffled shouts and cries of men fighting, the sounds carried tauntingly by the fresh night wind to the straining ears of those who waited. Janus remarked absently that he had sent out half a dozen scouts in an effort to discover what was happening at the river, but none had returned. An ominous sign. He had decided several times to go himself, but a gruff Hendel had reminded him each time that he had been placed in charge of the defense of Tirsis, and each time he had reluctantly discarded the idea. Durin had resolved in his own mind that if Balinor did not return by midnight, he was going out to search for his friend. An elf could travel undetected through almost any opposition. But for the time being, he waited like the others in growing apprehension. Cheryl spoke briefly of the unchanged condition of Palance Buckhanna, but she received only a disinterested response and quickly gave up the impossible task of trying to take their minds off the battle at the river. The little group waited 1 hour, then two. The sounds had grown slowly louder and more desperate, and it seemed that the fighting had moved closer to the city. Then suddenly, a vast formation of horsemen and foot soldiers appeared out of the darkness almost directly in front of the bluff, winding in staggered columns onto the wide stone rampway leading into the city. Their approach had been almost imperceptible, and their unexpected appearance from out of nowhere caused everyone atop the outer wall to gasp audibly. Janus Senpre sprang in alarm toward the mechanism that secured the iron fastenings to the giant gates, fearful that somehow the enemy had managed to outflank Balinor. But Hendel quietly called him back. He recognized what was happening even before the others suspected. Leaning out over the rim of the wall, the dwarf called down sharply in his own language and received an almost instant response. Nodding grimly to the others, Hendel pointed to the tall rider who had moved to the point of the long column. In the soft moonlight, the dust-covered face of Balinor peered upward,
the grim visage confirming what they all had suspected the moment they recognized him. The Border Legion had failed to hold the Myrmidon, and the army of the Warlock Lord was moving against Tirsis. It was nearly midnight when the five who remained together of the little band from Cullhaven gathered in a small, secluded dining room in the Buckhanna family home for a brief evening meal. The long afternoon and evening battle to hold the Myrmidon against the Northland army had been lost, although the cost in lives to the enemy had been terrible. For a while it appeared that the veteran soldiers of the Border Legion would succeed in preventing the floundering Northlanders from gaining the southern bank of the Swift River. But there were thousands of the enemy, and where hundreds failed, thousands ultimately succeeded. Acton's horsemen had swept lightning-like along the fringes of the Legion line, shattering every attempt by the enemy to outflank the entrenched foot soldiers. Advances into the heart of the Southland ranks had resulted in the death of hundreds of trolls and gnomes. It was the most dreadful slaughter Balinor had ever witnessed, and eventually the Myrmidon began to change color with the blood of the wounded and dying. And still, they kept trying, trying as if they were mindless creatures without feeling, without understanding, without human fear. The power of the Warlock Lord had so enslaved the collective mortal mind of the giant army that even death had no meaning. Finally, a large band of ferocious rock trolls breached the far right tip of the Legion's line of defense. Although they were slain almost to a man, the diversionary tactic forced the Tirsians to shorten their left flank. In the end, the Northlanders were across. By this time it was almost sunset, and Balinor quickly realized that even the finest soldiers in the world would be unable to retake and hold the southern bank once darkness set in. The Legion had suffered only mild losses during the afternoon's fighting, and so he ordered the two divisions to fall back to a small rise several hundred yards south of the Myrmidon and reassemble in battle formation. He kept the cavalry busy on the left and right flanks, making short rushes at the enemy to keep them off balance and to prevent an organized counter-thrust. Then he waited for darkness. The hordes of the Northland army began to cross in force as twilight fell. In mingled astonishment and fear, the men of the Border Legion watched as the hundreds that had first crossed turned to thousands, and still they kept coming. It was a frightening spectacle the bordermen beheld, an army of such incredible size that it completely covered the land on both sides of the Myrmidon as far as the eye could see. But its size hampered its maneuverability, and the chain of command seemed disorganized and confused. There was no concentrated effort made to dislodge the entrenched Tirsians from the small rise. Instead, the bulk of the army milled about on the banks of the southern shore after crossing, as if waiting for someone to tell them what to do next. Several squads of heavily armed trolls made a series of rushes at the Legion command, but they were equally matched in numbers, and the veteran soldiers quickly repelled them. When darkness came at last, the enemy army suddenly began to organize into columns five deep, and Balinor knew that the first sustained rush would break the Legion to pieces. With the skill and daring that had made him the spirit behind the fabled Border Legion and the finest field commander in the Southland, the Prince of Calahorn began to execute a most difficult tactical maneuver. Without waiting for the enemy to strike, he suddenly divided his army and attacked far to the right and left of the Northland columns. Striking sharply in short feints and taking full advantage of the darkness in terrain every borderman knew well, the soldiers of the Legion drew in the flanks of the enemy to form a ragged half-circle. Each time the circle grew tighter, and each time the Tirsians retreated a little farther. Balinor and Fandwick held the left flank while Acton and Messaline commanded the right.
The enraged enemy began to charge madly, stumbling awkwardly over the unfamiliar ground in the growing darkness, the retreating soldiers of the Legion always just a few steps out of reach. Slowly, Balinor drew his flanks in and narrowed his lines, pulling the searching Northlanders in with him. Then, when the foot soldiers had completely fallen back in retreat, covered by the darkness and the battle behind them, the skilled cavalry drew their lines together in a final feint and slipped from between the jaws of the closing enemy trap and was gone. Suddenly, the right and left flanks of the harried Northland army met, each believing that the other was the hated enemy that had eluded it for several hours. Without hesitating, they attacked. How many trolls and gnomes were slain by their own people would never be known, but the fighting was still raging when Balinor and the two divisions of the Border Legion arrived safely at the gates of Tirsis. The horses' hooves and soldiers' feet had been muffled to cover their retreat. With the exception of a squad of horsemen who had strayed too far west and been cut off and decimated, the Legion had escaped intact. Yet the damage done to the mammoth Northland army had not stopped its advance, and the Myrmidon, the first line of defense to the city of Tirsis, had been lost. Now the vast encampment of the enemy sprawled on the grasslands below the city, the night fires burning as far as the eye could see through the moonlit darkness. At dawn, the assault on Tirsis would begin as the combined strength of thousands of trolls and gnomes, obedient to the will of the warlock lord, hurled itself against the towering band of stone and iron that formed the outer wall. One would eventually shatter. Hendel, sitting thoughtfully across from Balinor at the small dining table, recalled again the ominous sensation he had felt earlier that day while inspecting with Janna Senpre the fortifications of the great city. Unquestionably, the outer wall was a formidable barrier, but there was something wrong. He had been unable to put his finger on exactly what was causing his uneasiness, but even now, in the solitude of the dining room and the warm companionship of his friends, he could not shake the nagging suspicion that something vital had been overlooked in preparing for the long siege that lay ahead. Mentally, he retraced the lines of defense protecting the sprawling city. At the edge of the bluff, the men of Tirsis had erected a low bulwark to prevent the enemy from gaining a foothold on the plateau. If the Northlanders could not be contained on the grasslands below the bluff, then the Border Legion would fall back into the city proper and rely on the mammoth outer wall to halt the enemy advance. The rear approach to Tirsis was cut off by the sheer cliffs that rose hundreds of feet into the air directly behind the palace grounds. Balinor had assured him that the cliffs could not be scaled. They were like smooth sheets of rock, completely without the normal nooks and crannies that would permit a foothold. The defenses surrounding Tirsis should be impenetrable, and yet Hendel remained dissatisfied. For a moment his thoughts drifted back to his homeland, to Cullhaven and to his family, whom he hadn't seen in weeks. He had never spent much time with them, his whole life expended in the ceaseless border wars in the Anar. He missed the woodlands and the green shading that came with the spring and summer months, and he suddenly wondered how he had let so much time pass without a visit home. Perhaps he would never get back. The thought swept through his mind and vanished. He had no time for regrets. Durin and Dale conversed soberly with Balinor, their own thoughts centered on the Westland. Dale, like Hendel, was thinking of his home. He was frightened of the battle that lay ahead, but he accepted his fear, encouraged by the presence of the others and determined that he would do no less than they in standing firm against the army that had come to destroy them. He thought quietly of Linlis, her shy, warm face a permanent fixture in his mind. He would be fighting for her safety as well as his own. Durin studied his brother, noting the sudden smile, and he knew without asking that the youth was thinking of the elven girl he was to marry. Nothing was more important to Durin than the safety of Dale. From the beginning, he had made a point of staying close to his brother to protect him. Several times during the long journey to Perrinor, they had nearly lost their lives. Tomorrow would bring still greater danger, and once again, Durin would be watching over his brother. Briefly, he thought of Eventine and the mighty elven armies, wondering if they would reach Tirsis in time. Without their great strength to supplement the Border Legion, the hordes of the Warlock Lord would eventually break through the city's defenses. He picked up his wine glass and drank deeply, the liquid warm in his throat. His sharp eyes surveyed the faces of the others and came to rest momentarily on the troubled face of Menyn Lee. Lean Highlander had devoured his dinner ravenously, having eaten nothing for almost 24 hours. Finishing long before his companions, he had contented himself with a fresh glass of wine, directing continual questions to Balinor about the afternoon's battle. Now, in the quiet hours of early morning, with dinner completed and the wine seeping through him like a slow drowsiness, it suddenly occurred to him that the key to everything that had happened since Cullhaven, and everything that would happen in the days remaining, was Alanon. He could not bring himself to think any more of Shae and the sword, nor even of Shirl. He could only see in the forefront of his mind the dark, forbidding figure of the mysterious druid. Alanon held the answers to every question. He alone knew the secret of the talisman men called the Sword of Shannara. He alone knew the purpose behind the strange appearance of the shrouded wraith in the Valley of Shale. The druid Bremen, a man over 500 years dead. He alone, in every instance, along every step of the dangerous journey to Perrinor, had known what to expect and how to deal with it. Yet the man himself had remained an enigma. Now he was gone from them, and only Flick, if he were still alive, could ask him what was going to happen to them. They all depended on Alanon for survival, but what would the giant druid do? What was left to him when the Sword of Shannara was lost? What was left when the young heir of Gerald Shannara was missing and probably dead? Menyn bit his lip in anger as the hated thought slipped quickly through his mind and was banished. Shae had to be alive. Menyn cursed everything that had brought them all to this sorry end. They had allowed themselves to be backed into a corner. There was only one path still open to them. In the holocaust of tomorrow's battle, human beings would die, and few, if any, would know the reason. It was an unavoidable part of war, that men should die for unknown reasons. It had been happening for centuries. But this war was something beyond human comprehension, this war between a substanceless spirit being and mortals. How could evil such as the Warlock Lord be destroyed when it could not even be understood? Only Alanon seemed fully to appreciate the nature of the creature. But where was the druid when they needed him most? The candles burned low on the table before them, and the darkness of the secluded room deepened. On the wood and tapestry-decorated walls, torches sputtered slowly in their iron racks, and the five voices dropped to low murmurs, hushed as if the night were a child in danger of being unexpectedly awakened. The city of Tirsis slept now, and in the grasslands beyond, the Northland army. In the peace and solitude of the moonlit night, it seemed that all forms of life were at rest, and that war, with its promise of death and pain, was merely a vague, nearly forgotten memory of years past. but the five who spoke in quiet tones of better days and the friendship shared could not, even for a few moments, completely stifle the lingering realization that the horror of war was no more distant than the sunrise, and as inevitable as the darkness of the warlock lord, reaching slowly, inexorably from out of the north to snuff out their frail lives. Chapter 30. On the morning of the third day of the search for Oral Fane, the torrential rains that had swept through the vastness of the barren Northland subsided, and the sun reappeared as a dim, fuzzy ball of white fire, burning through the misty darkness left with the passing of the warlock lord's black wall to the mud and rock-strewn terrain with the fury of an oven. The storm had left the topography of the land completely altered, the rains sweeping away almost every distinguishable landmark and leaving only four identical horizons of rocky hillocks and muddied valleys. At first, the appearance of the sun was a welcome sight. The heat from its rays penetrated the hateful gloom that had become permanently affixed to the barren surface of the earth to warm away the chill left by the now vanished storm as the temperature rose steadily and the character of the land began to alter once more. But in an hour's time, the temperature had risen 30 degrees and was continuing to rise unchecked. The rivers that washed through the winding gullies carved out by the force of the rain began to steam and mist in the heat, and the humidity soared, drenching everything in a new, even more uncomfortable wetness. The little plant life born in the aftermath of the devastating storm withered and died in suffocation, cut off from the sun's life-giving brightness and choked by the stifling heat that permeated the graying mist. The muddied earth lay unprotected from the heat and soon baked into a cracked, hardened clay that would support no life. The rivers and lakes and puddles began to dry up quickly, and in almost no time had disappeared altogether. The exposed surface of the huge boulders that dotted the parched land quickly absorbed the burning heat like iron settled in live coals. Slowly, inexorably, the land became what it had been before the rains had swept its surface. A dry, barren slab of earth, devoid of life, silent and forbidding beneath a vast, cloudless sky. The only movement came from the slow, unchanging arc of an ageless, disinterested sun as it followed its ceaseless path from east to west, turning days into years and years into centuries. Three bent figures stepped gingerly from beneath the shelter of a rocky alcove, cut in the side of one of the countless nondescript hillocks, their cramped bodies straightening slowly, their eyes peering grimly into the unbroken wall of mist. They stood for long moments in the lifeless gloom, staring into the dying land that seemed to stretch on forever, a dismal graveyard of rocky mounds that covered the mortal remains of those who had ventured into this forbidden kingdom. There was absolute silence filtering evilly through the misty grayness, hanging its unspoken warning of death in the minds of the three living creatures. They stood in apprehensive watchfulness, staring at the wasteland surrounding them. Shay turned to his companions. Panamon Creel was arching his back and rubbing his limbs in an effort to awaken the benumbed muscles. His dark hair was shaggy and unkempt, his broad face shaded by a 3-day beard. He had a haggard look about him, but the keen eyes burned warily as he met Shay's inquisitive stare. The massive Keltset had moved noiselessly to the summit of the hill and was surveying the northern horizon. They had huddled in the sparse shelter of their rocky alcove for almost 3 days while the fierce Northland storm had raged unchecked through the empty lands about them. 3 days lost in the pursuit of Oral Fane and the Sword of Shannara. 3 days during which all traces of the elusive gnome had been thoroughly obliterated. They had crouched restlessly amid the boulders, eating because it was necessary, sleeping because there was nothing else to do. Talking had given Shay and Panamon a greater understanding of one another, though Keltset still remained a complete enigma. Shay persisted in his belief that they should have ignored the storm and pursued their quarry, but Panamon had refused to discuss the idea. No one could travel far in such a storm, and Orlfane would be forced to seek shelter or risk being caught in a mudslide or drowned in the swift gully rivers. In any event, the thief had calmly reasoned, the gnome would have made little progress. Keltset descended from the crest of the hill, making a quick sweeping gesture with one hand. The horizon was clear. There was no further discussion of what should be done. It was already decided. Picking up their meager possessions, they trudged briskly down the side of the steep embankment, angling northward. For once, Shay and Panamon were in complete agreement. The search for the Sword of Shannara had become more than a matter of injured pride, more than a mission to seek out a mysterious talisman. It had become a dangerous, frantic hunt for the one means, however questionable, by which they might stay alive in this savage land. The fortress of the Warlock Lord lay amid the tall, black peaks directly north. Behind them lay the deadly wall of mist that marked the outer boundaries of the Skull Kingdom. To escape this hated land, they would have to pass one way or the other. The obvious choice was to go back through the misty darkness, but while the Elfstones might show them a passage to the Southland, using them would also reveal their presence to the spirit world. Alanon had told Shay so at Cullhaven, and he in turn had told Panamon. The Sword of Shannara was the one weapon that could protect them from the Warlock Lord, and if they had it in their possession, they could be assured of at least a fighting chance. The basic plan was to regain possession of the talisman and escape back through the Wall of Darkness as quickly as possible. It was hardly a brilliant strategy, but under the circumstances, it would have to do. Traveling was as difficult as it had been prior to the storm. The ground was hard and coated with rubble and loose topsoil that made the footing treacherous. Scrambling and clawing their way over the rough terrain, the three were quickly covered with dirt and bruised by continual falls. Because of the unevenness of the topography, it was difficult to keep their bearings and nearly impossible to calculate their progress. Landmarks were non-existent, and the country looked almost exactly the same in every direction. The minutes wore away with agonizing slowness, and still they discovered nothing. The humidity continued to rise, and the garments worn by the three men were quickly soaked through with sweat. They removed their cloaks and tied them on their backs. It would be cold again when the night descended. "This is the place we last saw him." Panamon stood motionlessly at the summit of the broad hill they had just scaled, breathing heavily. Shay reached his side and glanced about in disbelief. All the surrounding hills looked exactly the same as this one, save for small variations in size and shape. He stared dubiously at the horizon. He wasn't even sure where they had come from. "Keltset, what do you see?" the other man demanded. The rock troll strode slowly about the hilltop, scanning the ground for any trace left by the passage of the little gnome, but the storm appeared to have erased any signs. He moved about noiselessly for several minutes more, then turned to them and shook his head negatively. Panamon's dirt-stained face burned red in sudden anger. "He was here. We walk on a bit farther." They moved ahead in silence, scrambling unceremoniously down one hill and up the next. There was no further discussion. There was nothing further to be said. If Panamon were mistaken, nobody had any better idea except to keep looking. An hour crawled by as they labored northward. Still, there was nothing.
Shay began to realize the hopelessness of their task. It would be impossible to search all of the land stretching east and west. If the wily gnome had traveled just 50 yards to either side of them, they would probably never know he had gone that way. Perhaps he had been buried in a mudslide during the storm along with the sword, and they would never find him. Shay's muscles ached from the strenuous climbing, and he considered calling a brief halt to reassess their decision to proceed in this direction. Perhaps they should try to cut across the elusive trail. Yet a glance at Panamon's dark face quickly dissuaded the Veilman from even suggesting such an action. The tall adventurer had the same look in his face Shay had seen just before he had destroyed the gnomes days ago. He was the hunter once more. If Panamon found him, Oral Fane was a dead man. Shay shuddered involuntarily and looked away. Several hills later, they found a piece of what they were searching for. Kel'Thuzet spotted it from atop a small hillock, his sharp eyes picking out the foreign object as it lay half buried in dust at the bottom of a small ravine. Directing the other two, he slid quickly down the rock-strewn hill and rushed eagerly over to the discarded object, snatching it up and holding it out to them. It was a large strip of cloth, cloth that had once been the major portion of a tunic sleeve. They stared at it quietly for a moment, and then Shay looked at Kel'Thuzet for confirmation that it was indeed Oral Fane's. The giant troll nodded solemnly. Panamon Creel impaled the piece of cloth on the end of his pike, smiling grimly. "So we've found him again. This time he won't get away." But they didn't find him that day, nor did they discover any further signs of his passing. In the heavy dust, the gnome's footprints would have clearly shown, yet there were none. Despite Panamon's earlier opinion, Oral Fane had somehow wandered on during the storm, escaping both mudslides and drowning. The rain had washed away his tracks, but with freakish perversity had left uncovered the torn sleeve. It could have been washed down from anywhere, so there was no way to tell which direction the gnome had come from or gone. By nightfall, the blackness shrouding the land was so heavy that it was impossible to see more than several feet, and the search was reluctantly abandoned for the night. With Kel'Thuzet standing the first watch, Panamon and Shay collapsed in near exhaustion and fell asleep almost instantly. The night air was cool, though the humidity of the day lingered on, and all three wrapped themselves once again in the half-dry hunting cloaks. The morning returned all too swiftly in the familiar graying haze. This day was not as humid as the previous one, but it was no more cheerful. The sun was still nearly blotted out by the leaden mist that hung immovably overhead. The same eerie silence persisted, and the three men stared about with a feeling of complete isolation from the living world. The vast emptiness was beginning to have a noticeable effect on both Shay and Panamon Creel. Shay had grown edgy and nervous in these past several days, and the normally cheerful and talkative Panamon had lapsed into almost total silence. Kel'Thuzet alone retained his usual demeanor, his face as bland and implacable as ever. A short breakfast was consumed without interest, and the search began again. They resumed the hunt almost with distaste. Their common desire was to end this wearing trek quickly. They went ahead partly out of a sense of self-preservation, and partly because they had nowhere else to go. Although neither realized it, both Panamon and Shay were beginning to wonder why Kel'Thuzet continued the pursuit. He was in his own country and could probably have survived alone had he chosen to go his own way. The two men had tried unsuccessfully to decipher Kel'Thuzet's reasons for continuing on with them during the 3-day rain, and now,
too worn to reason the matter further, they had fallen back on suspicious acceptance of his presence and a growing determination that they would know who and what he was before this journey ended. They plodded on through the dust and the haze as the morning drifted dully into noonday. It was totally unexpected when Panamon suddenly drew up short. Tracks! The tall thief let out a wild yell of delight and charged madly into the small draw to their left, leaving both Kelset and Shay staring after him in amazement. Moments later, the trio knelt eagerly over a set of clearly defined footprints outlined in the heavy dust. There was no mistaking their origin. Even Shay recognized that they were made by gnome boots, worn and cracked about the heels. The trail they left was undisguised, leading generally northward, but weaving badly, as if the destination of the man passing were no longer certain. It almost appeared as if Orlfane were wandering aimlessly. They paused a moment longer and then rose hurriedly at Panamon's urgent command. The tracks were only hours old, and judging from their meandering nature, the elusive Orlfane could be overtaken easily. Panamon could only thinly disguise the almost vicious glee that surged through his revitalized body as he saw the end of the long hunt in sight. Without speaking further, the three hitched up their cumbersome gear and moved northward in grim resolution. This was the day they would catch Orlfane. The trail left by the little gnome wound in erratically confusing fashion through the dusty hills of the lower Northland. At times the three found themselves traveling almost directly eastward, and once they were turned about entirely. The afternoon wore on with tedious precision, and while Kelset indicated that the footprints were growing fresher, it appeared that they were still not gaining rapidly. If nightfall set in before they had caught up with their quarry, they might very well lose him once again. Twice before they had been on the verge of catching him, and each time an unexpected occurrence had forced them temporarily to abandon the search. They were not in the mood to have this happen a third time, and Shay had inwardly vowed that if need be, he would track Orlfane even in total darkness. The giant peaks of the forbidding Skull Kingdom loomed menacingly in the distance, their black razor tips jutting knife-like into the horizon. There was a sense of fear in the mind of the Veilman that he could not shake, a fear that had grown steadily stronger as the three men had pushed deeper into the Northland. He had begun to feel that he was undertaking much more than he had originally imagined, that somehow the search for Orlfane and the Sword of Shannara was only a small part of a much larger scheme of events. He was not yet panicked by what he felt, but he was prodded by an urgent need to finish this insane chase and turn back to his own land. It was mid-afternoon when the hilly terrain began to level off into a rolling plainland that enabled the three men to see for greater distances and to walk upright in an almost relaxed manner for the first time since they had passed through the Black Wall. The country ahead spread out before them with breathtaking starkness, a bleak, empty plain of brown earth and gray rock that rolled unevenly northward toward the tall peaks that bordered the Skull Kingdom and the home of the Warlock Lord. These vast flatlands diminished the farther north the eye traveled, breaking around the masses of rock and mountainous ridgeland that led in stepping stone manner to the awesome peaks beyond. The entire expanse, naked, hot, and desolate, lay masked in the same eerie, deathly silence. Nothing moved. No creature stirred, no insect hummed, no bird flew, not even the wind brushed against the layered dust. Everywhere there was the same blasted emptiness, unmarked by life, shrouded with death. The winding tracks of Orlfane led into this vastness and disappeared far in the distance. It was as if the land had swallowed him up. The hunters paused for several long minutes, their faces mirroring their obvious reluctance to proceed into this unfriendly land. But there was little time for weighing the merits of the matter, and they moved ahead. The twisting path was visible for a greater distance in this rolling plainland, and the three pursuers were able to track on a more direct course. They began to make up time quickly. Less than 2 hours later, Keltset indicated that they were no more than an hour behind their quarry. Dusk was rapidly approaching, the sun dipping behind a broken horizon far to the west. The dim twilight was masked further still by the ever-present gray haze, and the terrain was beginning to take on a peculiarly fuzzy appearance. The trio had followed the gnome's trail into a deep draw that was formed by a series of high ridges cropped by sharp overhangs and great, jutting rock formations. The fading sunlight was lost almost entirely in the shadows of the darkened valley, and Panamon Creel, who had eagerly taken the lead some time earlier, was forced to squint sharply to find the outline of the footprints in the heavy dust. They slowed to a halting walk as the thief bent closer to the earth. So intent was Panamon Creel on studying the tracks immediately before him that it came as a shock when the prints abruptly ended. Shay and Keltset were at his side instantly, and it was only after a careful study of the ground ahead of them that they were able to discover that someone had methodically brushed away all further traces of the little gnome's passing. It was in that same instant that the huge, dark forms began to detach themselves from the shadows of the draw, lumbering ponderously forward in the deepening twilight. Shay saw them first, but believed his eyes were playing tricks on him. Panamon was quicker to realize what was happening. Springing upright, the thief drew out the great broadsword and raised his pike. He might have made a rush to break through the tightening ring, but the normally predictable Keltset did a surprising thing. Springing quickly forward, he pulled the astonished thief back. Panamon stared incredulously at his silent companion, then reluctantly lowered his weapons. There were at least a dozen forms standing guardedly all around the three men, and even in the hazy twilight, a terrified Shay realized that they had been discovered by a band of giant trolls. The company of weary elven riders reined in their sweating mounts and gazed absently down the valley slopes into the broad length of the Wren. 2 miles of empty valley stretched eastward before them, the high slopes to either side cresting in sharp ridges lined with thinning stretches of trees and scrub brush. The legendary pass had served for over 1,000 years as the gateway from the lower Strelaheim plains to the great forests of the Westland, a natural door to the homeland of the elves. It was in this famous pass that the awesome might of the armies of the warlock lord had been broken in defeat by the elven legions and Jarl Shannara. It was here that Brona had faced and run from the aged Bremen and the mysterious power of the Sword of Shannara, run with his great armies back into the plainlands, only to be halted by advancing dwarf armies, trapped and destroyed. The Pass of Wren had seen the beginning of the downfall of the greatest threat the world had encountered since the devastating Great Wars, and the people of all the races looked upon this peaceful valley as a historic landmark. It was a natural monument of mankind's history that some had journeyed halfway around the world to see, just so that they too might feel somehow a part of that terrible event. John Lynn Sander gave the order to dismount, and the elven riders climbed down gratefully. His concern was not with the history of the past, but with the immediate future. Worriedly, he stared at the heavy black wall descending from the Northland across the plains of Strelaheim, its hazy shadow drawing daily nearer to the borders of the Westland and the home of the elves. His sharp eyes peered far into the eastern horizon where the darkness had already permeated into the forests surrounding the ancient fortress of Perenor. He shook his head bitterly and cursed the day he had permitted himself to leave the side of his king and oldest friend. He had grown to manhood with Eventine, and when his friend became king, he had stayed with him as his personal counselor and self-appointed watchdog. Together they had prepared for the invasion of the armies of Brona, the spirit lord they had once believed destroyed in the Second War of the Races. The mysterious wanderer Alanon had warned the elven people, and while some had scoffed in misconceived disdain, Eventine had known better. Alanon had never been wrong. His ability to see into the future was uncanny, but unerringly accurate. The elven people had followed Eventine's advice, and they had prepared for war, but the invasion did not come as expected. Then Perenor had fallen, and with it the Sword of Shannara. Again Alanon had come to them, asking that they patrol the plains of Strelaheim above Perenor to guard against any attempt by the gnomes holding the druid fortress to move the sword northward to the castle of the warlock lord. Again they had obeyed without question. But the unexpected had happened, and it had happened while John Lynn Sander was away from the king. The gnomes entrenched at Perenor had unexpectedly decided to break for the safety of the deep northland, and three heavy patrols made a rush at the elven lines. Eventine and John Lynn had led separate commands to intercept two of these forces and would have destroyed the gnomes easily had it not been for the planned intervention of a combined army of gnomes and trolls detached from the now advancing northland army of the warlock lord. John Lynn's command was nearly annihilated, and he barely escaped with his life. He had been unable to reach Eventine, and the elven king had disappeared with his entire patrol. John Lynn Sander had been searching for him for nearly 3 days. "We will find him, John Lynn. He is not an easy one to kill. He will find a way to survive." The grim elf nodded with a barely perceptible shake of his close-cropped head, his darting eyes glancing quickly at the young face of the man standing next to him. "It's a strange thing, but I know he's alive," the other continued soberly. "I can't really explain how I know. It's just something I can sense." Breen Elicidal was Eventine's younger brother. He was also the next king of the Westland Elves if his brother were dead. It was a position he was not yet ready for and quite honestly did not want. Since Eventine's disappearance, he had done nothing to assume command of the languishing elven armies or of the dismayed king's council, but had joined immediately in the search for his brother. As a result, the elven government was in a state of near chaos, and what had only 2 weeks earlier been a people united against the imminent threat of invasion from the north was now an unsure, divided cluster of separated groups, badly frightened because there was no one prepared to assume leadership of the government. The elven people would not panic altogether. They were far too disciplined to allow matters to fall apart totally. But Eventine had been an undeniably powerful personality, and the people had been united solidly behind him since his ascension to the throne. Young, but possessing unusual strength of character and an infallible common sense, he had always been there to advise them, and they had always listened. The rumors of his disappearance had shaken the people badly. But neither Breen Elicidal nor John Lynn had time to worry about anything but finding the missing king. After skirting gnome patrols and the main body of the Northland army while they searched, the haggard survivors of the decimated elven patrols had returned briefly to the tiny outland village of Koos, where they had obtained fresh horses and supplies. Now they were on their way back to pick up the search once more. John Lynsander believed he knew where Eventine would be found if he were still alive.